Today, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker signed a law that prevents unions from making private sector workers pay fees. Speaking at a factory in Milwaukee, he said the law will help attract new businesses from other states.
They look at one more tool, one more arrow in that quiver that says Wisconsin now has the freedom to work. That is one more powerful tool as we help create not just jobs, but career opportunities.
This comes after the Republican governor famously slashed collective bargaining rights for most public sector workers back in 2011. And it makes Wisconsin the 25th state in the country with a so-called right-to-work law. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He's with us from New York to discuss. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
And let's start with the term here. Remind us what exactly a right-to-work law does.
A right-to-work law, as you said, essentially says that nobody can be required to pay union dues. So to understand why this undercuts unions, let's say that the workers at my magazine form a union. And on behalf of bargaining for my wages, that union requires a fee. Right-to-work says I don't have to pay that fee. Some people might say this sounds completely reasonable. People who don't want to be in the union can't be required to pay the union dues. But it creates something of a death spiral. If I don't pay my fee, then my colleague says, well, I don't want Derek freeloading or free riding, so I won't pay the fee either. And so she doesn't pay the fee and her friend doesn't pay the fee and so on until you have a death spiral as people stop paying the union fee and it itself dies a slow death. So it's a very effective way of undercutting unions themselves.
And why is it called a right to work law?
I think it's a bit of rather brilliant marketing. It's rather unobjectable to be against the right to work. And so this is a very clever way of saying we're going to frame our strategy of undercutting unions by saying that we're not against unions. We are for work. We are for the individual rights of workers to not pay union dues.
And Derek, as we said, Wisconsin is now the 25th state in the country with a so-called right-to-work law. And you look just right down south of Wisconsin in Illinois, the governor there, the Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, clearly wants to move the state in that direction. Can we expect these laws to just become commonplace across the country?
Absolutely. You'd have to think that if Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, even Illinois can pass right-to-work laws, it's hard to imagine. And there's many states that we should be confident that right-to-work can't take hold. And you know, I think this is because of two things. First, right-to-work polls quite well for the very reason that it is, as you said, a wonderfully affable term. But there's also the demographics. In the 1950s, just about every family either had a worker in a union or knew a family that had a worker in a union. And that's when union participation in the private sector was close to 40%. Now it's around 6% in the private sector. And so you have a lack of familiarity with unions themselves, which allows people who are fervently against them, I think, to control more of the conversation.
Well, can we look at the workers who are in unions and the workers who are not in unions now as compared to back in the 1950s, as you say, and show what that means? What does it mean for workers both in and out of unions to see the decline in the labor movement?
At the same time that you've seen union membership decline since the 1950s, 1960s, you've also seen equality decline. When union membership was at its century high, the share of income concentrated in the top 10%, this is a very common way to look at inequality, it was at its century low. So you can love unions, you can hate them, you can think they're killing jobs, but it seems to me very, very clear that the record of equality in the 20th century suggests that unions are a force for good when it comes to raising the wages of its members. The problem now is that just as changes in technology in the 1930s and 40s created this sort of perfect time, a golden age of unions in the middle of the century, technology right now and globalization is stripping out a lot of these manufacturing-heavy, routine-heavy jobs where union membership was so concentrated. And so I think you have in economics, in politics, in technology, sort of a triple wave against union membership. And I think we should all expect it to continue to decline in the next few decades as well.
Where's public opinion on this, Derek? And I'm thinking specifically of different generations, the younger generation that didn't grow up with everybody being in a union.
Public opinion on unions has basically collapsed since the Great Recession, and it's collapsed across the board. And, you know, one thing that demographers say is that when things are bad, people blame institutions. And so you've actually seen the decline in approval for unions fall at about the same rate that decline in trust has fallen for Congress and for business as well. But as you said, there's a generational component to this too. It's interesting that on the one hand, you don't have a lot of young people familiar with broad-scale union membership. But ironically, support for unions is highest among young people than any other age group. Senior citizens, it's also high as well. So you tend to see union support highest among lower-income demos, highest among minorities, and then highest also among younger and much older workers.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. You can weigh in on this with your thoughts at our website, hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.